And we've noted also Leonardo da Vinci, who lived from 1452 to 1519, lucid interpretation of fossils. A Frenchman, Descartes, who lived from 1596 to 1650, speculated boldly upon the incandescent beginnings of our globe, and a Dane, Steno, who lived from 1631 to 1687, began the collection of fossils and the description of strata. But it was only as the 18th century drew to its close that the systematic study of geology assumed such proportions as to affect the general authority of the Bible version of that ancient Sumerian narrative. Contemporaneously with the universal history quoted above, a great French naturalist, Buffon, was writing upon the epochs of nature in 1778, and boldly extended the age of the world to 70,000 or 75,000 years. He divided his story into six epochs to square with the 6 days of the creation story. These days, it was argued, were figurative days. They were really ages. There was a general disposition to do this on the part of the new science of geology. By that accommodating device, geology contrived to make a peace with orthodox religious teaching that lasted until the middle of the 19th century. We can't trace here the contributions of such men as Hutton and Playfair and Sir Charles Lyell and the Frenchmen Lamarck and Cuvier in unfolding and developing the record of the rocks. It was only slowly that the general intelligence of the Western world was awakened to two disconcerting facts. Firstly, that the succession of life in the geological record didn't correspond to the acts of the 6 days of creation, and secondly, that the record, in harmony with a mass of biological facts, pointed away from the Bible assertion of a separate creation of each species straight towards a genetic relation between all forms of life in which even man was included. The importance of this last issue to the existing doctrinal system was manifest. If all the animals and man had been evolved in this ascendant manner, then there had been no first parents, no Eden, and no fall. And if there had been no fall, then the entire historical fabric of Christianity, the story of the first sin and the reason for an atonement upon which the current teaching based Christian emotion and morality, collapsed like a house of cards. It was with something like horror, therefore, that great numbers of honest and religious-spirited men followed the work of the English naturalist Charles Darwin, who lived from 1809 to 1882. In 1859 he published his Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, a powerful and permanently valuable exposition of that conception of the change and development of species which we sketched briefly in Chapter 3. And in 1871 he completed the outline of his work with The Descent of Man, which brought man definitely into the same scheme of development with the rest of life. Many men and women are still living who can remember the dismay and distress among ordinary intelligent people in the Western communities as the invincible case of the biologists and geologists against the orthodox Christian cosmogony unfolded itself. The minds of many resisted the new knowledge instinctively and irrationally. Their whole moral edifice was built upon false history. They were too old and set to rebuild it. They felt the practical truth of their moral convictions, and this new truth seemed to them to be incompatible with that. They believed that to assent to it would be to prepare a moral collapse for the world, and so they produced a moral collapse by not assenting to it. The universities in England, particularly, being primarily clerical in their constitution, resisted the new learning very bitterly. During the 70s and 80s, a stormy controversy raged throughout the civilized world. the quality of the discussions and the fatal ignorance of the Church may be gauged by a description in Hackett's commonplace book of a meeting of the British Association in 1860, at which Bishop Wilberforce assailed Huxley, the great champion of the Darwinian views, in this fashion. Facing Huxley with a smiling insolence, he begged to know, was it through his grandfather or grandmother that he claimed his descent from a monkey? Huxley turned to his neighbor and said, "The Lord hath delivered him into my hands." Then he stood before us and spoke these tremendous words. He was not ashamed to have a monkey for his ancestor, but he would be ashamed to be connected with a man who used great gifts to obscure the truth. Another version has it, "I have certainly said that a man has no reason to be ashamed of having an ape for his grandfather. If there were an ancestor whom I should feel ashamed in recalling, it would rather be a man of restless and versatile intellect, who plunges into scientific questions with which he has no real acquaintance, only to obscure them by an aimless rhetoric and distract the attention of his audience from the real point at issue by eloquent digressions and skilled appeals to prejudice." These words were certainly spoken with passion. The scene was one of great excitement. "A lady fainted," said Hackett. Such was the temper of this controversy. The Darwinian movement took formal Christianity unawares suddenly. Formal Christianity was confronted with a clearly demonstrable error in her theological statements. The Christian theologians were neither wise enough nor mentally nimble enough to accept the new truth, modify their formulae, and insist upon the living and undiminished vitality of the religious reality those formulae had hitherto sufficed to express. For the discovery of man's descent from subhuman forms doesn't even remotely touch the teaching of the kingdom of heaven. Yet priests and bishops raged at Darwin. Foolish attempts were made to suppress Darwinian literature and to insult and discredit the exponents of the new views. There was much wild talk of the antagonism of religion and science. Now, in all ages, there have been skeptics in Christendom. The Emperor Frederick II was certainly a skeptic. In the 18th century, Gibbon and Voltaire were openly anti-Christian, and their writings influenced a number of scattered readers. But these were exceptional people. Now, the whole of Christendom became, as a whole, skeptical. This new controversy touched everybody who read a book or heard intelligent conversation. A new generation of young people grew up, and they found the defenders of Christianity in an evil temper, fighting their cause without dignity or fairness. It was the orthodox theology that the new scientific advances had compromised, but the angry theologians declared that it was religion. In the end, men may discover that religion shines all the brighter for the loss of its doctrinal wrappings. But to the young it seemed as if indeed there had been a conflict of science and religion, and that in that conflict science had won. The immediate effect of this great dispute upon the ideas and methods of people in the prosperous and influential classes throughout the westernized world was very detrimental indeed. The new biological science was bringing nothing constructive as yet to replace the old moral standbys. A real demoralization ensued. The general level of social life in those classes was far higher in the early 20th than in the early 17th century, but in one respect, in respect to disinterestedness and conscientiousness in these classes, it's probable that the tone of the earlier age was better than the latter. In the owning and active classes of the 17th century, in spite of a few definite infidels, there was probably a much higher percentage of men and women who prayed sincerely, who searched their souls to find if they had done evil, and who were prepared to suffer and make great sacrifices for what they conceived to be right, than in the opening years of the 20th century. There was a real loss of faith after 1859. The true gold of religion was in many cases thrown away with the worn-out purse that had contained it for so long, and it wasn't recovered. Towards the close of the 19th century, a crude misunderstanding of Darwinism had become the fundamental mindstuff of great masses of the educated everywhere. The 17th century kings and owners and rulers and leaders had had the idea at the back of their minds that they prevailed by the will of God. They really feared him. They got priests to put things right for them with him. When they were wicked, they tried not to think of him. But the old faith of the kings, owners, and rulers of the opening 20th century had faded under the actinic light of scientific criticism.